Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Joins us for the weekly update here on a Friday at JM in the AM. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to the show.
Good morning.
Malcolm has announced, or the folks at Young Israel of Midwood have announced, that he will be 2 weeks from tonight speaking at the Young Israel of Midwood in what is an annual oneg or lecture appearance in Brooklyn, New York. You'll have an opportunity to hear Malcolm live and in person if you're in Brooklyn, plus ask questions in their Q&A 2 weeks from tonight for the details to follow. Malcolm, what is your reaction to the EU, the European Union, being awarded the 2012 Nobel Peace Prize?
Well, I have to say that I think that by and large it's the first time an award is given like this just for being. I don't know what the specific contribution to world peace, except that within the European Union itself, one can say that they have brought some level of cooperation and coordination, that the existence of the body diminishes perhaps the chance of war in Europe. One doesn't know what the long term will be, given the different trends, the rise of extremism and certainly of anti-Semitism. The role that the EU, certainly the EU foreign minister, has played is very questionable, and they are now flirting with certain issues that are very sensitive. So I guess there was no individual or organization that they felt warranted the prize this year beyond the EU. It'll be the subject, I'm sure, of a lot of discussion.
In the summary I saw in the Jerusalem Post, it says, and the EU, by the way, folks, is 27 nations. A fact that I didn't have an accurate number on that till this morning. For rebuilding after World War II and its role in spreading stability to former communist countries after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Now, what's the backstory, Malcolm? I hate to bring up the cynical aspect of this, but you would suspect that aside from not having any clear individual candidate, what else may have influenced the prize going in this direction?
Well, it's probably the events of the last years with the economic collapse of certain, or near collapse of certain countries, and the fact that European Union was able to raise the funds and have Germany, the stronger economies, bail out the weaker economies like Greece and Spain. And although we're not past this crisis altogether, I assume that that was a motivating factor, and that perhaps did it not exist, you might not have had the kind of response, and the consequences could have been perhaps more dangerous to Europe. But I have to say that I'm not a big fan of the EU, given some of its actions. Mm-hmm. They do speak out on the anti-Semitism issues. They do speak out. The question is the actions that they take, and I think, well, maybe this will inspire them. I'm not sure I want to see them play a more activist role, as some have said, in Middle East peace or things like that, because the positions they take are not always that great. And on Iran sanctions, they've been supportive, and they have worked with the U.S., but frankly, the implementation has not been as strong, given even the recent arrests in Germany and elsewhere, to see the full implementation of those sanctions.
I wonder if a representative from each country is going to be on stage to receive the award. That would make for quite a scene.
That would be very interesting.
You may agree, you may not, but I don't know how anybody in a leadership role in the Jewish world or anywhere can be critical of regular folks who cannot describe the danger that Iran poses to the world, to the free world, in terms of nuclear enrichment, when it seems to me, as a regular guy watching the vice presidential debate, that the two vice presidential candidates have difficulties articulating the danger.
It's an interesting point.
Do you know, if you read the transcript of last night's debate, and I do have it here, and I could try to cite some of it, but if you read the transcript, nobody is able to, neither of them, rather, is able to articulate what the problem is. In addition to that, Prime Minister Netanyahu at the UN, and we discussed this last week, if you missed it, folks, it's worth heading back to the archives from Erev Shabbos Chol HaMoed, Prime Minister Netanyahu really laid it out that once the enrichment is complete or near completion, that is when the last stage of danger begins. It seemed from both vice presidential candidates last night that neither of them understood that there is not a very big gap in time between the end of that enrichment and loading up a nuclear weapon.
Well, what the vice president was trying to say is that they don't have the weaponization part ready.
Do you know how Netanyahu, how quickly he said that could be done?
Well, it's not quickly that it's done. He said once you have the enriched uranium and if you have all the other pieces in place, that it can be assembled very quickly. But the fact is that the weaponization process has been underway for many years. That it's not something that it may not be complete, but to say that they don't have it, we know in some of the missiles that they tested, and we reported this years ago, that they had the spherical head cone in which you could place a nuclear weapon. It does not mean that it is complete, but they certainly have the missile delivery system, which is part three. Part two is weaponization. Part one is enrichment. Enrichment, everybody agrees, they're much further ahead. I don't think Netanyahu spoke about the spring and people, when she asked him about 2 months, because he said the spring, I think he said the summer, which would have given much more time. Second, I thought that Ryan laid out at the issue of it being the leading state sponsor of terror, about its violations, et cetera, and the danger that it poses.
And they both spoke of sanctions and all that, right?
But the truth is that the IMF yesterday came out with a report, the International Monetary Fund, saying that sanctions, while they're having an impact, are not going to do it, and that that they continue to sell oil. They're selling oil for cash, which means that the regime is swimming in dollars, and the people are suffering, and they don't care about the people are suffering. The IEA this week was threatened that they would not be able to have access to certain other facilities. We don't know if they have the secret facilities that they claim. We know that the plutonium facility, the heavy water facility, is functioning. And if the IMF is saying that the sanctions have a limited hit, look, I think the point that was trying to be made is that we're 4 years further down the road. We're actually 20 years down the road, certainly 10 years of negotiations, which have not produced a result. I don't think there was clarity. I think it was Ryan who pointed out the arms race, the nuclear race that will be set off in the region, which is also not talked of often, though Netanyahu certainly did. Lavrov, the foreign minister, this week started playing it down, saying Israel doesn't have to fear an Iranian nuclear weapon. That's very good if you're not Israel and you don't have somebody threatening to destroy you.
Right.
And they're now threatening cut off the access of the inspectors, which it could shut down any time. Look, sanctions are hurting them. They're having an effect. The real is in collapse, the currency. But it doesn't stop one centrifuge. And I think the message yesterday was not strong. The Iranians warned the UAE over islands that are in dispute. They're continuing in the same provocative method, and certainly in Syria. We know around the world, and Chavez's win only emboldens them further, because the first thing he announces is that he'll continue to support Assad in Syria and Iran. I think that the global danger of Iran was missed. This is not just about Israel. The instigation and the role that they play, and thinking about what it means if they do what they do today, what it would mean if they had the nuclear capacity.
Right, because, and again, if I understand what you're saying, the potential nuclear arms race in the Middle East, citing again Ryan's analysis, is not half the danger of the Iranians having it. Especially, I mean, certainly to Israel, but even to the United States, you would say, right?
Of course. But they don't. You have to have the missile delivery system. They have it. They're working with North Korea. We know that they have gotten technology from European countries and from others, including American-trained nuclear science.
Right, but I don't even mean that. What I'm saying is that the race is one thing. It's an issue that has to be dealt with like it's always been dealt with, because there are always countries pursuing nuclear weapons, and we hope that it falls into the hands of countries who could deal with it responsibly. And that has to be dealt with. That's separate from the issue, as you say, of a country that has committed to destroy Israel and its allies.
But not just made verbal commitments. Look at the attacks through Hezbollah through the last years, the 20 attempts at major terrorist attacks all over the world. the attempt against the American ambassador of Saudi Arabia. It's not hypothetical. That my point is that you're dealing with a real danger that is immediate, and you don't get the sense of urgency about what the real nature of the threat that Iran poses.
All right. I want to try to be as critical as of both vice presidential candidates, so I'm not accused of anything. So Ryan says, we can't allow Iran to gain a nuclear weapons capability. Let's look where we've gone and where we've come from. When Barack Obama was elected, they had enough fissile material, nuclear material, to make one bomb. Now they have enough for five. I think he would have been better off just quoting Netanyahu and explaining how close, because I'm sure half of America was saying to themselves, wait a second, they have that much already, why don't they have a nuclear weapon already? And then Biden responds, my friend talks about fissile material, they have to take this highly enriched uranium, get it up from 20%, then they have to be able to put it in. There's no weapon the Iranians have at this point. Both the Israelis and we know will know if they start the process of building a weapon. Netanyahu spent half of his speech talking about that we won't know when they start building the weapon.
Well, and the second part then goes to your original question, is that even if you know, you may not have the time because they
what can you do about
more
it, right?
Advanced. The Parchin nuclear base, which nobody has had access to, had facilities that they believe were used for testing, for weaponization, for part of the process of weaponization. We know that there were other steps taken and material that was shipped to Iran that has to do with weaponization. And weaponization means that stage where you take the nuclear material and have the bomb in which to put it that you put inside the missile or the other delivery system.
Here's the quote from Netanyahu. Iran could produce the nuclear detonator in a lot less time, maybe under a year, maybe a few months. The detonator can be made in a small workshop the size of a classroom. It may be very difficult to find and target that workshop, especially in Iran. That's a country that's bigger than France, Germany, Italy, and Britain combined. The same is true for the small facility in which they could assemble a warhead or nuclear device that can be placed in a container ship. Chances are you won't find that facility either. Neither candidate last night expressed the urgency of this situation, and when given the opportunity, did not talk about how we're just months away from this situation.
And you know, it also assumes that our intelligence will be such, if we didn't know that the Al-Qaeda cell could attack the Libyan embassy of the United States, and the vice president was saying that they didn't, that was the word that they were being given. We saw the NIE report, the National Intelligence Estimate report, a few years ago, which said that they had stopped, the Iranians had stopped in 2003, 2004, and et cetera, et cetera, and that has since been contradicted. So you can't rely and assume that intelligence is going to be able to provide it. You know that there are enough signs, and my point was that we've uncovered over the years and had reports over the years on the show about many things that have been discovered scientists who have defected and IAEA inspectors have said would indicate that the weaponization process could well be underway.
Right.
It's not completed, perhaps, but it's certainly underway.
There's another debate coming up. I think it's Tuesday. I hope
it won't be on foreign policy. This one is going to be on, the presidential debate will be on economics domestic. The third one will be foreign policy.
So that's the 22nd. I hope by then the two presidential candidates can better articulate what the situation is and what they would do regarding the situation.
I think that I assure you that all of the people working for both sides are now back there trying to figure out if you should smile a lot or smile a little, interrupt or not interrupt, and about substance, hopefully, as well.
And that's always third, right? Substance. Style over substance. America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning Radio Program. Heard on listeners sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Well, I don't know if you pay attention to my Facebook update page, Malcolm, but I did post a picture of the only bumper sticker I've gotten so far from the upcoming Israeli election. Someone sent me a Netanyahu bumper sticker. Sounds like you're jealous that you'd like one.
I'm surprised that they're out there so fast.
Oh, they're out there, all right.
You better check if it's counterfeited.
And I hope, as I asked from our Israeli listeners, I'm hoping that they'll send us some more over the next couple of months. Looks like it's going to be a heated election process. We originally, or I should say last week, we spoke of new Israeli elections. I think it was February 12th or 13th. Is that date or does that week still look like the likely week for the election?
No, the election is going to be January 22nd.
Ooh.
It requires a 3-month advance notice. I think Netanyahu wants it as soon as possible because it denies the opposition more time to organize. And the Knesset will start voting, I think, Monday when they come back to session post-Yontif. post the holidays, and will move to dissolve itself in the government, and then the clock will run till January 22nd when the elections will be held.
So that's 100%? That's it? 22nd of January?
Yep.
So it should be
announced. That's 100%.
Right. It should be.
But in Israel, 100% doesn't mean tomorrow.
100%. Yeah, that's for sure. So this should be a very interesting election season in Israel. And for a country that's sick of election campaigns, I guess it's better to get it over more quickly than what we've gone through for the last 24 months.
Well, the fact is that this government has lasted, I think, longer than any government. It lasted almost into the fourth year. The election would have to be held in October anyway. The government runs out in October. Its term runs out. And I think Netanyahu would use the guise of the budget, passing the budget, for calling elections, but I think he recognizes that he's right now in a stronger position, that the longer you wait, some say it was Yair Lapid's rise, some say Olmert's, the threat of Olmert coming back, if he gets out of the Holy Land trial unscathed or relatively unscathed. It seems that Israelis are ready to have him back. Polls show that if he leads this super center-left group, that they would get 31 seats. Of course, these polls are really hypothetical, and certainly the assumption that that could happen is hypothetical. I don't think all the parties are prepared to subjugate themselves in that way, but the Kadima would certainly, I think, look for some venue to improve its showing, which right now I think is down to 10 or even less seats. Labor are virtually non-existent. Under Yachimovich, Labor, I think, would get 10, 12, but not as the rival party. So the right seems to be stronger and in a good position. The longer you wait, that could become more endangered. So I think that Netanyahu did his assessment and felt that this is probably the best time to move ahead.
There's a poll that's talking about Netanyahu getting 68 seats.
Now, that's the coalition of all the parties.
Right.
That's right. Lieberman met yesterday with Olmert. You know, you have all of the jockeying and all of the positioning and playing off against the different parties. So you will see all of that going on in the coming weeks. And the of course, as you said, the real issue is Iran. And I guess you don't want to have an election or a campaign ongoing if it's necessary to take decisions vis-a-vis Iran.
Well, that's for sure. And you would describe the Israeli economy worse now than a year ago, or basically the same? Or because is that an issue also for Netanyahu to try?
That will be the issue. It won't be on Iran. Iran will be his issue, but the real thing will be the economic social agenda.
Is it so different than it was a year ago?
Well, it's certainly worse. It's been impacted by the global conditions. You know, Israel exports to Europe and to the rest of the world, and those exports get affected when the economies and countries can't purchase or don't purchase. Every country is affected, and Israel has built in some good shock absorbers, and Netanyahu can take credit for when he was Secretary of Minister of Finance. Certainly the Stanley Fisher and he have worked together and done a good job trying to minimize the impact, but the social issues will be dominant. You do have serious problems. You still have the gaps, the have and have nots, and the demonstrations last year reflected it, even though this year you did not see a replication of those demonstrations.
Now, Olmert is, because you indicated that the Israeli people are probably willing to accept him back into the world of politics, but is this more of a media creation? Is he a media darling in Israel and they're trying to force him in?
Well, I think that they see him as the credible alternative. Right now, the Israeli media is in such disarray with several facing bankruptcy and all sorts of financial and other problems. So the media there, which often drives the electoral cycle and the politics in Israel, rather than reporting it, is less in a position, but to have a favorite. But they certainly are looking for an alternative. You know, it's not good for newspapers if you have one candidate who's so dominant you don't tell them that you have a good, you know, fight. So they need to have a race, and I think Olmert could be the figure that could lead that. And polls show that the Israeli people are very forgiving.
We have no race. Let's create a race. It's unbelievable. What did you make of this report that the prime minister, meaning Netanyahu, agreed to return the Golan in talks 2 years ago? Or I should say give away the Golan.
And I don't think he agreed to give it away. There were talks that he did have a representative speak with Assad, not me, and he did have, you know, they did have some preliminary discussions. I don't think it ever came down to really a decision to give it away. But if you remember, other governments, Barak, I think even Rabin, had talked about it, that for a real peace treaty and to work out some deal, it doesn't mean that everybody would have had to vacate right away. There are all sorts of arrangements that were being spun, but it never got very far.
Yeah, Prime Minister Netanyahu, according to the Yediot, the Prime Minister's office denies it, agreed in principle to withdraw from the Golan as part of a peace agreement with Syria. Negotiations took place in the fall of 2010. You mentioned earlier about the Chavez victory. A lot of regular folks wonder how someone like this can continue to win elections. Is it because of the economic situation being so good?
Well, first of all, you know, they have so much oil, and he uses the income for his political purposes to benefit his supporters. He appeals to the poor class. He appeals to, on an ideological level, to people. He's the election, I think, certainly is suspect and always will be.
Even when it's that close? If you're going to rig it, why not give him a better percentage?
No, because if you make it too ridiculous, nobody would believe it at all.
Yeah, but he was only at, what, 54%?
Well, I think it was 8 million to 6.5 million. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty big difference. Mm-hmm. And Capriles, who is a descendant of Holocaust survivors, he's not Jewish himself. But they made that an issue. They mocked him. The campaign was obviously very intense and very dirty. People got killed in the process. The fact that on the first day after the election, he said that he's going to continue his relationship with Iran and the support for Assad. And I think that this is a message to others in South America. This guy who has cancer and was very sick. Somehow, I don't know, the bad guys don't die, but whether he'll live out this term is very unclear, so he may move more vigorously. There were many people who thought that Capriles was ahead. In fact, the reports, even to just before the end of the vote of the election, gave him an edge at the end of the counting. Many people feared his victory because of the consequences in terms of riots in the streets and how the Venezuelan army and others would have reacted. You know, they have the equivalent of the Basiji. You have huge Hezbollah and Iranian presence there, as well as Palestinians and others. Hezbollah has training camps there, and there was a lot of fear about what this will mean for the Jewish community, which has dwindled a lot. I think you will see many more people leaving because of the economic policies, which will obviously hurt those who are in better economic positions. The question of how aggressive he will be, what he will do, his anti-Americanism is so vicious. You know, he created an alternative to undermine the Monroe Doctrine and create his own Organization of American States equivalent. So you're going to see him be, I think, at least as aggressive in the past in supporting and being part of the evil axis with Syria, with Iran, with others, and to try to extend their influence in South America.
How long is his term officially?
6 years.
Were you surprised to see that the folks that are being suspected in the Paris store attack had ties to Syria?
I wasn't surprised by it. The question of whether that it means it's directly related to groups in Syria or groups based in Syria, where you have a lot of people playing from Al-Qaeda to the Iranians and Hezbollah, etc. So the direct tie, it may not be very surprising. We will find out more about the connections. But, you know, we know that a number of people from France, young people, went to Syria to fight after the Toulouse incident, after the killing of the rabbi and the children and three others, soldiers in Toulouse. they reported, doctors reported in Venezuela, treating people who came to fight there as saying that they were inspired by Mohamed Mara, the guy who carried out the attack. So there is a relationship there, and having Syria's hand, or a Syrian source as being a hand in a terrorist attack, or providing weapons and other things. And I think, you know, you look at Iran, all of the attacks that Iran was involved in, the attack in Bulgaria, which they had tried 6 months earlier, New Delhi, Georgia, Azerbaijan, Thailand, it's not surprising at all. People just don't take it seriously. And that goes back to the question of Iran having a nuclear capacity. Think of all this terrorist network would also be able to draw on dirty bombs.
Was there a UN reaction to the Afghanistan killing of that, not killing, but shooting of that girl? Trying to think who...
Yeah, I don't think that there was any formal reaction, nor was there any reaction to 37 missiles being fired across Israel's border, and they refused to condemn it. And the Israeli ambassador spoke about it yesterday at the UN, but I don't recall seeing one.
All right, excuse how long it took to get to the drone, but a lot of people want to know about this, certainly. So now Nasrallah, Hezbollah, has taken responsibility and says he sent the drone that Israel shot down into Israeli airspace, and obviously this has caused a lot of concern among Israelis and among those who care about Israel. He says it's not the first time that Hezbollah has done this. What can you tell us about the drone?
Well, the drone was allowed to fly for a while. Israel wanted to shoot it down in an area without any population. They are reassembling it now. They do say its origin is Iran. Hezbollah's leader says it came from Iran and said that they sent it. I think it was a message to say, look, we have capabilities of doing this, and that the next war won't simply be missiles, that we can send drones armed with weapons. But I think it was more likely to do surveillance. You know, they built a mock-up of Dimona and of Haifa in Iran for Hezbollah training, and I think in Hezbollah territory as well. They have been focusing, and the real a very real danger is the indication that they may be planning across border raids, and that in the event of a conflict that they would try to move into, Hezbollah would move across the Lebanese border into the northern Galilee, that they try to recruit Israeli Arabs in the past for this purpose, to do spying and to perhaps be an advance front for them. The drone itself shows that they have more sophistication, the fact that they could get it along the Mediterranean to bring it into to Israel,
right.
And that the Iranians are obviously assisting them in this. But I think Hezbollah, the danger you have to look at is the rising levels of violence that we see from both sides. What's happening in Gaza, the increased missiles, Hamas being more aggressive. Hamas, for the first time since June, taking credit for attacks, saying that they shot, you know, 30 rockets. You see the coalition of Al-Aqsa brigades and Islamic Jihad groups who claim that they shot 50 mortars in one day. I don't know if the number is right, but this is their claim. It's probably less. But nonetheless, they are talking about a joint council. And at the same time, we see that Egypt has diminished its efforts in Sinai, and Morsi announced that he's not going to pursue the people in the Sinai, the terrorists who carried out the attack against Israel or against the Egyptian soldiers. Actually, the efforts till now have been minimal. He put on a good show, but not, in fact, they do anything that serious. And we see them engaging with Turkey in joint naval exercises, a much more aggressive external policy. I think the events on the Turkish-Syrian border, which I hope we can get to, is also a very significant part of this, and is of far greater importance than I think people tend to recognize.
All right, and we'll get to that in a second. Can I just ask you one more drone thing? It seems like this has had an interesting psychological effect. We've seen Hezbollah, you know, build up their rocket supply and their bases, weaponry, sneak weapons in from Iran and other places, and really threaten Israel from the north. And in fact, Israelis have been the victim of, you know, war from the north due to Hezbollah. But it seems that this drone infiltrating Israeli airspace had a greater psychological effect on the Israeli people. Is that accurate?
It's psychological, military, other aspects. Of course, it is a significant thing when they can penetrate the Israeli border, fly for as it did for the time. And again, I think the Air Force let it fly. They wanted to monitor it, and then took it downwind and thought it was the appropriate time. They said that it had failed in its intelligence mission, and I think if it had gotten near Dimona or near any other sensitive place, they would have shot it down earlier. So, number one, it shows that they can track it. It shows that they can take it down. But you can launch a lot of drones at the same time. It would be very hard, perhaps, to get them all.
Wow. Turkey and Syria. Go ahead.
Look, I think that what's happening on the Turkish-Syrian border, aside from what's happening in Syria itself, where you had yesterday 13 Hezbollah guys caught near homes by the opposition forces, it gives an indication of the extent of Hezbollah involvement when they, at the same time that they try to deny that they are so involved. Turkey forces down a Syrian jet coming from Russia, claims that they took off weapons. Syria is now demanding that they show the weapons. It was first claimed to be parts of a missile, later ammunition. Putin reams Erdogan.
Right.
Real conflict there, potential. Russia anyway being sensitive to what Turkey is doing on the border, which I'll get to.
Mm-hmm.
And Assad then takes control of the armed forces directly, partly because I think he has a big leadership gap. The Saudi king gets outraged, which is not the usual mode for him, and attacks Assad, threatens each other. They're all threatening each other. We see new groups now, this coalescence of groups emerging, and the parties inside Syria are saying, well, we don't see the aid from the U.S. that they say they're giving. We don't see the non-lethal aid, meaning not weapons, but humanitarian and other aid. So you have all these factions fighting each other. The one concerted effort, though, is what happens on the Turkish-Syrian border. And people think it's a border skirmish, that it was because of the missiles that flew across from Syria to Turkey.
Right.
I think that this is a deliberate plan. There will be provocations to give cover for Turkey to establish a 50-kilometer zone, initially a much shorter one, and then, if possible, a much broader one, 50 kilometers from Kilis on this Turkish border up to Aleppo.
For what purpose?
To bring down the government. It will go till Aleppo. If Aleppo falls, Assad can't stay.
Right. You've explained that to us many times.
And I think that this is a Morsi, Erdogan, Riyadh, Doha plan, which excludes the West. You saw that NATO took a very almost standoffish policy supporting Turkey after the quote assault, and it's not at all clear who's really responsible for that assault. Did the Syrian forces do it? Did Free Syrian forces fire these missiles that, you know, became the provocation for these attacks? I'm saying that this is very complicated. I think it's very significant that we have to watch this carefully.
One, as complicated as it is, though, there's an assumption that has to be made, and that is that everyone you just mentioned wants Assad out.
Those parties want Assad out at any cost now.
So Morsi, there's no doubt in your mind that Morsi wants Assad out.
Yes, and that's why I cited the king, because his expressing rage at Assad gives further credence to the fact that they're all lining up for the removal. And the question is, who fills the void? And I think that came up in the debates as well yesterday, that we don't see a leader right now who is capable of doing it, and we don't see even a coalition, because the parties that are fighting there, and we see more and more Islamists coming in, we see jihadists coming in, we see not just Al-Qaeda. We know that even Syria perhaps is sending in forces into the opposition just to be in a position to have some say in that coalition, and of course do spying, etc. They still support the Assad regime fully. So the prospects of Assad's remaining is certainly something that this coalition of parties is determined to make sure that he's out.
Is this going to expose Putin's allegiance in the region?
Well, I think Russia has made it clear, and even Lavrov in comments this week it continues to make clear, and one of his arguments is you're going to create a circumstance where you don't know what the final outcome will be because you don't have a leadership. You have the internal forces have very little relationship to the external.
But in reality, they're just big Assad fans, right?
In the meantime, Iraq just bought $4 billion, announced $4 billion in weapons purchases from Russia. $4 billion from Russia, not from the United States.
But in reality, the Russians are simply big Assad fans. And as much as they're trying to keep...
Well, they have vested interests. I think they're all disappointed in Assad and the way that he's handled this, and certainly won't come out publicly.
But they're going to feel the need to support him.
They're going to feel the need. And you know that, again... Everything is so complicated, and we try to cover the different points that people to look for. But one of the big developments was in regard to Jordan and the spillover of the
refugees.
And the United States sent 150 troops, but I don't believe that they're there to handle the refugees. I think it's much more to do with the instability internally in Jordan. The demonstrations that we spoke about that took place last Friday actually turned out to be much smaller than had been anticipated. The pro-government demonstration was canceled. Yesterday, they appointed a new prime minister and a reformist government, something the king has been trying to do in terms of constitutional reform and moving slowly and constructively. But the internal forces there are certainly growing more dangerous. And Jordan is a key country for Israel, for the region, for all United States. Saudi Arabia worries very much about it because the fall of Jordan into the hands of Islamists or others would have grave consequences. So that's another thing that is, and it's directly impacted by the and undermined further by the flow of 150,000, I think, refugees into Jordan.
But the alliances are forming now. Like, everyone's worried about Iran. I mean, the alliances are now forming in the Middle East with Russia backing one of them. That could lead to God knows what type of incident. I mean, I don't want to say world war, but I mean, it could. We're heading in a very bad direction if this tension continues between, you know, with Turkey and Syria being at the center of it.
Well, and the goal there is to create a Sunni. You'd have to look at the Sunni Shiite battle that this entails also, and that certainly could activate Iran with its allies in Hamas and Hezbollah. They could try to create, if in fact the things on the events on the Syrian-Turkish border heat up, Hezbollah could create a diversion with Israel and force Turkey then not to do it, because then they'll say, look, you're aiding the Zionist ally. This is a conspiracy between you and Israel, etc.
Right.
So there are a lot of potential ramifications and scenarios.
And all we're worried about is Iran.
And at the same time, you have the PA going into an election in December, the local elections, which Abbas is going to steal. Hamas in having problems within in Gaza, and certainly control problems. The Sinai situation that I mentioned, but Hamas is boycotting the election in Gaza, but will do whatever they can to undermine the Abbas regime there. And Abbas says now that he's going to go in November, November 29th, to go to the UN, and that after that he'll talk about peace talks. And Europeans issued a pretty strong warning to him this week about taking such a unilateral move. But this election's the first since 2006, and he's not going to allow control to be lost because of all the corruption, everything else that's entailed.
Follow the money trail.
It's so we have so many shifting plates, but what's important is to step back and try to look at the patterns, and why I outline what the interrelationship between all of these issues are.
Unbelievable. With that, we wish everybody a happy new year.
No, listen, this is not...
I know.
There's no potential outcomes, but it depends if people are going to look ahead, and if they're going to be farsighted, not to take each... I'm talking about governments.
I know. When the vice presidential candidates exhibit publicly the fact that they don't know the issues, and I know I'm being harsh, but you get my point, it starts to scare me.
Well,
they got to be...
Or are unable to articulate...
Right, to articulate the issues. Exactly.
In a way that give the American people a clear picture of the dangers that we're facing. I mean, they did talk about it, and you know, it's a difficult format. You have very limited time.
I understand.
And they've all been programmed or super programmed, you know, to make certain points. And I wish that it was much freer and people were really, I mean, Biden has many years' experience. He was chairman of foreign relations. He certainly has been around the issues for decades. And Ryan is certainly very bright, knows the issues, has studied it as well, been prepared. But I don't think that they serve the purpose of really exploring the issues and telling people what next year anybody would do about the issues that we face.
Agreed. All right, Malcolm, we're way over. Thanks so much. Have a wonderful Shabbos. We'll speak next week. Malcolm Hohnlein, it's been announced, will be at the Young Israel of Midwood 2 weeks from tonight. If you can't get enough of him Friday morning, you could face him face-to-face on the 26th of October. Young Israel of Midwood for his annual Flatbush Brooklyn appearance. You get an opportunity to see him present and then to ask him your questions. Yeah? You don't like the questions I ask, or you think I should be asking other questions? Here's your chance. Go and ask them live and in person. See how it goes. I'm sure it'll be great.